Welcome back, everybody. Today is the grand finale. Can everybody hear and see me okay? Yeah, okay, great. Just let me know if you don't. All of a sudden, I had some issues earlier today. Okay, so here we are, closing our journey through the book of Genesis, a journey that started from the relationships in Eden between Adam and Eve and Adam and God, and moved on through many other relationships in this book. And today we're going to try and bring it all together. And just as it is in the Parshas, when you move from, when you move to Vaigash, so it was in our class. We finished last class by seeing the final, complete, solid estrangement between Joseph and his brothers. We saw the process by which the father's preference to Joseph's becomes a hatred, and how this hatred translates into murderousness, and how step after step after step of the way, we see the family falling apart. And the story is so powerful and so thorough in emphasizing the horror, in emphasizing cruelty, in emphasizing the way the brothers sat down to eat while their brother was lying in the pit, that you can't help but wonder, how on earth can anyone come back from this? How is there any way back? How can such a total and cruel and harsh breach of trust and breach of compassion ever heal? And we will focus, there's many answers, obviously, but we will focus today on three keys that lie in different places, so to speak, in the complicated network of relationships that spans between Joseph, his different brothers, and their father, Jacob. And we'll see how all of these three keys are crucial, not only for allowing this one family to overcome their history, but also in many ways for bringing all the different strands and ideas that we followed through the book of Genesis to a crescendo, to their fulfillment, to their to fruit, so to speak. The first fruit, the first key I want to talk about today is a key that Rashi, actually, the commentator Rashi, brings into the discussion. And the key that he brings into the discussion is the concept of compassion. There's a moment when Joseph is already in Egypt, and he has become the viceroy of Egypt. He's responsible for collecting all the food of Egypt during the years of plenty, and then when there's years of starvation, years of famine, people from all over the world come to Egypt to buy grain from them, and he's responsible for this whole process. And his brothers, 10 of them, not Benjamin, who is his full brother from Rachel, but isn't sent out of the house because now the father, Jacob, who already lost one of Rachel's sons, refuses to let Benjamin out of his sight. 10 of the brothers, the 10 who sold him, or what attacked them at any rate, come to Egypt to buy food. And we hear the following, I'm here in box one in the source sheet. For though Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Vayakir Yosef et echav vehem lo ikiru. Now, it sounds perfectly reasonable. It doesn't sound like the kind of thing that requires complicated explanations. After all, when they sold him, he was a 17-year-old boy. And when they sold him, the last they saw of him is this beaten up boy who's about to be a slave. Why would they associate him with the viceroy of Egypt standing there talking to them harshly, asking them, telling them, are you spies? What are you doing here? Why would they make this connection? Well, the reverse is easy enough to see also, that of course he recognized them. They were already adults, adult grown men when they sold him. And they remain the same adult grown man, except a bit grayer and more wrinkled, perhaps. But they didn't undergo such changes of fate as he did. And yet, despite the fact that this sentence seems perfectly clear, Rashi does add another explanation. First, the first explanation, which I didn't include in this page, is indeed what I just said, that he was a boy and therefore they didn't recognize him now as an adult. But something bothers Rashi. Rashi doesn't feel like this is enough, and he adds the following. A midrashic explanation is Joseph recognized his brethren. Now that they were in his power, he recognized them as his brothers and had pity on them. But when he fell into their power, and we remember a different time, they did not recognize him as their brother by acting towards him in a brotherly manner. In other words, when he was in their power as a 17-year-old boy, they beat him, put him in the hole, and sold him, and didn't listen to his cries, didn't listen to anything he might have said or not said. Whereas he, when he sees him and he is in a position of power, has compassion. And the obvious question is, why does Rashi need to introduce this here? Why is this important? Rashi is not fond of adding explanations for artistic's sake. He adds things that are simple and clear when he feels that there's a need for them in a text. What is the need in the text that Rashi is trying to address? Before I address that, I want to point out that maybe Rashi himself takes this idea, or more accurately, the sages who devised the Midrash, the story that this is his explanation is based on, maybe they took the idea for this from a certain point later in the story. Because later in the story, there's a moment when the brothers explain their story to Joseph, and he says, "You are spies," and he puts them in prison, and they are the ones who bring up the concept of compassion. They are the ones who make a connection between their suffering now and what happened between them and Joseph all those years ago. They talk to each other here in Genesis 42, I'm still in box one. They said to one another, "Alas, we are being punished on account of our brother, because we looked on at his anguish, yet paid no heed as he pleaded with us. That is why this distress has come upon us." I want to point out that there's many things they can regret and treat as the source of their current trouble. They could have said, for example, "Alas, we are being punished on account of selling our brother to a slavery." Or they could have said, "Alas, we are being punished on account of our brothers, of our father for lying to him about our brother." They could attribute their current misfortune to so many different things. But what they focus on, what's on their mind, is that moment when he felt anguish and they sat and ate and didn't pay him any heed. When he was in the pit and they were not open to him. Tellingly, Joseph's response is very heartfelt. Then Reuben spoke up and said to them, "Did I not tell you, do not wrong the boy? But you paid no heed. Now comes the reckoning of his blood." They did not know that Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between him and them. He turned away from them and wept. But he came back to them and spoke to them, and he took Shimon from amongst them and had him bound there before their eyes. And this is a moment when he says, "Okay, I'll hold Shimon as hostage, and I'll give you an opportunity to prove that you are not in fact spies by going back to your father and bringing me the last brother, Benjamin, and thus proving that you spoke the truth." In this scene, we see the brothers recalling a moment when they saw their brother suffering and blocked themselves from responding to it emotionally, from having any corresponding emotion. And in the very same scene, we see Joseph having a strong emotional response to this revelation or this moment of confession, this moment of regret on the brother's part. We see him stepping aside and crying. This is an action that he's going to repeat once more when he sees Benjamin for the first time. When they finally bring Benjamin down, he's going to also cry. He's going to be overwhelmed by the need to cry. And these descriptions of Joseph, cryptic, calculating, mysterious Joseph, bursting out in tears, perhaps help us understand why Rashi thought that compassion has to play a significant part in the story and brought it in earlier already. Because in a sense, what happened between the brothers and Joseph, if you look at it rationally, shouldn't have been fixable. There's no way back from that. On some rational level, there's no reason for Joseph to ever trust his brothers again or desire any good for them. In order to overcome these rational observations, these rational calculations of vulnerabilities, of grace, of forgiveness, something has to happen, something has to come, some force has to wash into the scene that upends cold rational calculations. Something has to come and break them and move the people past, past the obstacles, the unpassable obstacles that they have built for themselves. And this is where compassion comes in. Compassion expressed in Joseph's tears is that force that goes beyond reason, beyond calculation, beyond fairness, beyond justice, and brings him to tears and allows for a new story to begin. In a sense, when Rashi says that him recognizing them and them not recognizing him is all about the imbalance, not of recognition, but of compassion, he's teaching us something very deep about the meaning of compassion, because on some level, compassion is, in fact, a recognition. It's this recognition of someone else's pain. It's this recognition of someone else's authentic experience as something that demands something or affects us in some way. When the brothers, seeing their brother Joseph in a hole in the ground, beaten by them, stripped by them, sit down and eat bread together, what they do is put a wall between them and their brother's suffering. They close it off. They don't allow themselves to recognize it and be moved by it. And this is what started the estrangement. This is what started the process that eventually brings all of Israel to Egypt. When Joseph, in a similar situation, seeing them in a bowl, but not a hole in the ground, but rather a prison, a bowl kele, a prison, where he placed them, just as they placed him in a bowl, in a hole earlier, and hearing their anguish, allows himself to respond and cry. When he hears it, he is opening the door for correcting the path, for reopening a story between them, for creating the rapprochement that will eventually bring the family back together. So this is the first key. But the proof is, before we can delve back into the Joseph story and see what other things are needed in it, we should take a step back and note that this moment, the moment when Joseph feels something and is allowing himself to be moved by this thing that he feels, doesn't only correct or balance or mirror the moment when the brothers withheld compassion. In many ways, it echoes or changes the pattern we saw time and time and time again in Genesis of people withholding something deep within themselves from the other. Think about Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve see each other, and there's this very much moment of recognition, of hakara, lehakir, to recognize. When Adam looks at Eve and says, "Zot apam etzem yetzamay basam," so this time, bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, I see myself in you. You are mine and I am yours. And it looks wonderful, and it looks like this moment of recognition opens the door, and it does open the door for the relationship between them and for all the human relationships to come. But very soon after that, we see Eve alone in the garden talking to the snake. And when she tells the snake what God told Adam to tell her, namely, don't eat the fruit, what she says is, God told us not to eat or touch the fruit. Did she just add it? Or did Adam fail to pass the message correctly? For the first time, we see the shadow of a doubt, the possibility that one person withholds something, in this case, information from another, and that this opens the door for the trouble to come. But this is very subtle. Later, we saw cases of withholding that were much, much harsher and stronger. We saw Rebecca withholding truth from Isaac. She sees him making what she thinks is a mistake. She doesn't go and talk to him. She doesn't express it. She manipulates the situation by guiding her son Jacob in a way that does gain Jacob the blessings, but also breaks apart the family completely. And she's withholding what she has inside at that moment. We saw Jacob withholding things from his brother Esau in the scene of their great reunion. After many, many years, Jacob is coming back from Haran. They're having a reunion. And it's very moving. And we see Esau running towards Jacob and hugging him. And they're hugging each other. And it's beautiful and moving. But the way Jacob talks to Esau throughout is deceitful. It doesn't express what he really thinks or what he really feels. He adopts or assumes, almost like a costume, a sort of servility, a sort of subservience to Esau. And then when Esau says, come with me, he says, oh, I have children. They walk too slowly. I have sheep. If I walk them too fast, they're all going to die. I'll get to you eventually. Never really following up on that. So even in that moment of great emotional communion or a great emotional upheaval, there's an act of withholding. And later we saw the brothers themselves in the beginning, before selling Joseph, before beating up Joseph, before even hearing Joseph's dreams, we see the brothers hating their brother Joseph because of the father's love and the ornamental tunic he wears and being incapable of speaking to him. They are withholding speech. And here comes Joseph and turns the tide and opens the door for a reconnection between estranged people by letting go, by allowing his authentic self to express itself, first in hidden tears that he turns away to express, to cry, and eventually, as we will soon see, in tears that he allows the brothers to see, tears that he cries on their own necks. But we will get to that shortly. First, let's go back into the story. Shimon is a hostage. The brothers go back. Jacob does not want to send Benjamin down with them. For a very long time, they're all there without food. And Jacob refuses over and over again to send his beloved son Benjamin down. Once again, Jacob is unabashed and showing his favoritism. Just as in the beginning of the story and at the root of this entire saga, we see Jacob gifting a special gift to his son Joseph, showing his preference. Here we see Jacob showing his preference to Benjamin by refusing to put him in danger while endangering everybody in his family through hunger and accepting the fact that Shimon, another of his sons, is held hostage in Egypt, and God knows what's going on with him there. And this time, two sons step up. The same two sons who made particular impact on the story of the sale of Joseph, Reuven and Yehuda, step up. And just as in the story of the sale itself, Reuven made a gambit that ultimately failed while Yehuda succeeded. Namely, Reuven said, instead of killing him, let's put him first in the hole, intending to later come and save Joseph from the hole. But by the time he came back, there was no Joseph there anymore, and he failed. And Yehuda, on the other hand, said, oh, let's sell him, which in fact did happen. Years later, when the time is ripe for either sending Benjamin down or starving, Reuven makes a failed gambit, and Yehuda succeeds. Reuven makes an offer that to our ears sounds very bizarre. He says, if I fail to bring back your son Benjamin, kill my children. Which, even as a child, I found very odd because these are Jacob's grandchildren we're talking about here. How would killing them help Jacob in any way? And Jacob, in fact, does reject it. He does not agree to it. He does not want to hold by it. And then Yehuda steps up and says, Anochi arev et hana'a. I am responsible. I take responsibility for the boy, the na'a. The word na'a in this context, again, ties the story back to two previous stories. Two of the previous stories we saw in the relationship stories of the Abrahamic family. because there are moments, there's moments of high crisis when both of Avraham's children almost died, where they were called Na'a. The first was Ishmael, who was dying of thirst in the desert. And the second is Yitzchak, bound on an altar, bound on an altar on Mount Moriah by God's order. In both of those cases, the child is called Na'a, even though in its heart space, at least, it doesn't sound like it's right. Na'a is usually an adolescent boy, and according to the count of the years, Isaac was much older at this point. But that doesn't matter. What matters is that something about those moments of crisis calls forth this word, boy, and Yehuda goes back to this word and says, I will be responsible. My soul is responsible. I'm putting my immortal soul, I'm putting my own name, my integrity, my everything on the line. I am Arev. The root in Hebrew is Ein Resh Bet. We use it today to describe solidarity, but it's much more than that. It's a blood responsibility almost. And then Jacob agrees and sends Benjamin down. And at first, Joseph accepts them in a great celebration, tells them everything's okay. But as he sends the brothers and Benjamin away, he hides his silver drinking cup, wine cup, in Benjamin's bags. And he sends soldiers after the brothers to search them. And when they find the silver item in Benjamin's bag, they drag all the brothers back, and Joseph tells them, okay, I'll take Benjamin to be my slave. You are all free to go. Thus, artificially recreating the same situation. Here are the 10 brothers. Here is the son of Rachel, the beloved son of Rachel, the man who holds their father's love over all of them. And here they are given an opportunity to save themselves at his expense. It's a nice variation on the moment when they sold Joseph, because here they don't have to sell Benjamin to get rid of him. It's taken out of their hands. They just need to go along with a plan. And it's in this moment that we encounter the next key to fixing everything that is broken in Jacob's family. And the next key is revealed to us in Judah's speech at this moment, when Judah steps up and says, no, I can't allow for you to take Benjamin. You must take me instead. What is it about this speech that's so special? There's a lot of special things about this speech. We're going to read it now together, and I'll point out several of them. But what I want to focus on towards the end of the speech is one of the less noticed or less celebrated aspects of what Judah does here. So let's look at it together and see why it's so crucial. I am here in box 2 in Genesis 44. Then Judah went up to him and said, please, my Lord, let your servant appeal to my Lord and do not be impatient with your servant, you who are the equal of Paro. My Lord asked his servants, have you a father or another brother? We told my Lord, we have an old father, and there is a child of his old age, the youngest. His full brother is dead, so that he alone is left of his mother, and his father dotes on him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me that I may set eyes upon him. We said to my Lord, the boy cannot leave his father. If he were to leave him, his father would die. But you said to your servants, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, do not let me see your faces. Now Yehuda recaps what happened when they got home with that knowledge. When we came back to your servant, my father, we reported my Lord's words to him. Later, our father said, go back and procure some food for us. We answered, we cannot go down. Only if our youngest brother is with us can we go down, for we may not show our faces to the man unless our youngest brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, as you know, my wife bore me 2 sons. Note here that he calls Rachel my wife. He doesn't say one of my wives. She is the wife. Leah is an afterthought for him. Rachel is the wife. My wife bore me two sons. Now imagine all the brothers hearing that, right? Imagine them hearing that, hearing their mothers dismissed and themselves dismissed. Because the sons, the two that are important, are Rachel's sons, not them. But one is gone from me, and I said, Jacob says, alas, he was torn by a beast, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me too, and he meets with disaster, you will send my white head down to Sheol and sorrow. Now, if I come, and here Yehuda adopts his own voice again, to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, since his own life is so bound up with his. When he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die, and your servants will send the white head of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in grief. Now, your servant has pledged himself for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, I shall stand guilty before my father forever. Therefore, please let your servant remain as a slave to my lord instead of the boy, and let the boy go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father unless the boy is with me, Hana'a, the boy? Let me not be witness to the woe that will overtake my father. I read it in its entirety because I think, first of all, it's a beautiful speech, one of the most powerful speech probably in the entire Hebrew Bible or in history, depends how you look at it. But secondly, because I want to point out that I want to unearth, unpack together with you a certain strand that runs through all of it. When we read it or hear it in shul or listen to it, listen to someone reading it, we often focus on many of Judah's amazing qualities that are revealed in this moment. We focus on his bravery, on his willingness to self-sacrifice. He's showing here the kind of leadership that will earn him position of leadership from his, that his father eventually will acknowledge, as we will discuss soon. We can acknowledge the show of solidarity, the fact that a son of Leah is willing to sacrifice himself for a son of Rachel, going across the invisible line that divided Jacob's family for too long. Many people talk about how the idea of chazara b'tshuva, of returning from sin, as Maimonides points out, can only be tested if we're ever tested in the same situation. We can only really know that we corrected whatever it is we did wrong is when we are faced with the same situation, we do the right thing. So many people focus on that. They point out that this is a situation very much, as we described, like the situation before. There's the son of Rachel, there's the other brothers, and they can allow him to disappear from their midst. And Yehuda is correcting and proving that he learned from his experience by standing up and demanding. But what I want to focus on is something different. What I want to focus on is not on Judah, the brother here, Benjamin's brother, who stands up for him. I want to focus on Judah, the son. How did the entire story of Joseph and his brothers, the horrible story of estrangement, start? It started with a father who loved one son above all others. And the other sons could not accept that, could not live with that. For them, that translated into hate, into withholding speech from Joseph, and eventually violence. And here is Yehuda acknowledging the same love that was the root of all these bad responses in the brothers before. He keeps repeating and saying, my father said to my wife for me. He puts on the table the fact that Jacob loved Rachel and her sons over everybody else. He says, my father didn't want to send this son. And he keeps saying, Avi, Avi, my father, my father, my father. And he says, if this son doesn't come back, my father will die. And the implication is, if I don't come back, it's not as bad. And what does he do with this knowledge? What does he do with this understanding that nothing he can do will ever make his father love him as much as he loves Benjamin? He sacrifices himself. instead of being motivated to hatred, to vengeance, to apathy. You could imagine a son growing apathetic towards his father in this circumstance, even if he's not hating him in response. Instead of allowing any of those responses to evolve within him, Judah accepts it. We often say, it's a very known refrain, that to love is not to feel something, it is to be willing to do what's good for the person you love and not what's good for you. Yehudah epitomizes this common refrain in this moment. He is willing to sacrifice himself for his beloved father, out of love for his father, out of care and responsibility for his father, even though his father doesn't reciprocate this love in the same way. And it is very, very powerful that it is in this moment that he calls Benjamin Na'al, because it is almost as if he becomes the angels, that's the angel in the Akedah, and says, there will be no killing today. I will not let this son be bound and killed. I will not let this boy, Na'al, be sacrificed. I am willing to take the cost. Only when Judah, and Judah specifically as the leader of the brothers, shows that the love Jacob still feels towards Benjamin and Joseph no longer affects the brothers in the same negative way, can we ever talk about rebuilding something? Because the love is still there. The preferential treatment and the preferential love is still there. If the brothers still can't live with it, it doesn't matter at all that Joseph would feel compassion, that Joseph would embrace them. They would forever remain bitter and estranged from him and angry because the root cause of the problems remains. Now that the Yehudah shows Joseph that the brothers can live with the reality as it is and accept it and be brothers regardless of their father's love, this is the moment when the door for reunion truly opens up. And this is also the moment when finally Joseph doesn't have to hide his tears. And in box 3, Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants. In Hebrew, litapek is more than control, it's to withhold. He cried out, have everyone withdraw from me, so there is no one else about. When Joseph made himself known to his brothers, his sobs were so loud that the Egyptians could hear, and so the news reached Pharaoh's palace. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still well? But his brothers could not answer him. So downfounded were they on account of him. In Hebrew, it's kinivhalu. They were scared. You can imagine the response, right? You can imagine them when they realize that this man, the viceroy of Egypt, the man with power of life and death over them, is also the brother they once wronged and beaten and threw into a hole and eventually sold into slavery. This is a very scary moment. So even though Joseph finally lets his compassion and lets his tears and lets his inner feelings go and reveals himself, literally reveals himself, all of himself to the brothers, they can't respond in kind. The fear, the guilt stands between them. And this is where the third key comes in. And the third key is one that Joseph wields very intentionally and very carefully in the way he talks to his brothers now. He says the following. I'm going down. It's the continuation of the same piece right here. Then Joseph said to his brothers, come forward to me. And when they come forward, he said, I am your brother Joseph, he whom you sold into Egypt. Now, do not be distressed or reproach yourself because you sold me hither. It was to save life that God sent me before you, ahead of you. I want to point out two things in these two remarkable verses. The first is that when Joseph sees the brothers' silence, an echo of the silence they all started with, right? The silence where they couldn't let the bro l'shalom speak to him in peace. They're again silent, this time out of fear. His response is not to bury or repress or hide what lies between them. To the contrary, he puts it directly on the table, saying, I am your brother Joseph, he whom you sold into Egypt. He leads with that. He puts the trauma out there on the table for all to see. Well, all is all of them, just them to see. And then he takes it. He takes this nugget of feeling that cannot be done away, and he recontextualizes it. He puts it in a different interpretive framework that makes the meaning of what they did different. And he says in verse 6, it is now 2 years that there has been famine in the land, and there are still 5 years to come in which there shall be no yield from tilling. God has sent me ahead of you to ensure your survival on earth and to save your lives in an extraordinary deliverance. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Paro, lord of all of his household and ruler over the whole land of Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me without delay. Only after Joseph does this, only after Joseph offers them a way to look at their own past that enables them to forgive themselves, can the gates be opened between them truly. I'm here going down to verse 12. Verse 14. With that, he embraced his brother Benjamin around the neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. He kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. He allows himself to express everything he is on their flesh, physically with them. Only then were the brothers able to talk to him. V'charei ken dibru echav ito. Only after all three keys are in place, compassion, an ability to accept the father's love and not resent the brother for it, and an ability to look at the past as more than the sum of petty enmities, but rather as something that's part of a bigger, broader plan, something that has redeeming qualities, something that they can move past because it had some silver linings to it. Only then are their brothers freed from that blight that lay upon their relationship from the get-go, the blight of speech. I mentioned at the end of last week's class, the Hasidic idea, the Kabbalistic idea, really, that the Egyptian exile is an exile of speech. It's a time when we lose our ability to speak, to express ourselves. And I pointed out that the brothers are foreshadowing that national catastrophe, that national loss of identity and expression when they lose their ability to speak. And here we see the beginning of the healing of that. We also see a healing that goes further back than just the beginning of Joseph and his brothers. It's a healing that runs through towards or fixes or mirrors or reflects on all the brothers' relationships in Genesis. The very first brother relationship in Genesis, the one we started talking about brothers with, the relationship between Cain and Abel, doesn't seem on the outset to have anything to do with speech. And yet, despite being on the face of it very, very different, it does include a similar moment that hints to us that when brothers are not at peace with another, they can't talk to one another. Something blocks the communication between them. If you look with me at box 4 here below, Genesis 4:8, Cain said to his brother Abel, and when they were in the field, Cain set upon his brother Abel and killed him. There are no three dots. Like here, there are three dots in the translation. I'm not exactly sure why, because in the Hebrew, there's no three dots. It's as if we hear, and he said something to him, but we never hear what the something is. It just skips right away to the murder. There's a pause. When we discussed it a few weeks ago, we said that perhaps the pause here stands for the fact that no matter what Cain had to tell Hevel, no matter what grievance he held towards him, it could never justify murder. There's a certain eclipse here of meaning because whatever he says doesn't add up to whatever he does. it's just insignificant what he said. It can't be significant in this context, in the context of deciding to kill, rationalizing a murder. I want to offer a different interpretation now that we can look back at it through the prism we acquire from the Joseph story. Perhaps that little gap there, that little moment where he says something, but we never hear what he says, expresses not the insignificance of the communication, but rather the deep block of it. The fact that on some level, there can't be real communication when there's hate. Perhaps because when we hate one another, we're not communicating with one another. Whatever we say is said to the image of the other, we create it in the image of our hate. I don't talk to the person I hate. I talk to the imaginary construct I created out of my negative feelings towards him. So Cain, when he says something here, it doesn't matter what he says because he's not really communicating. There isn't really an act of communication. When the brothers finally relaxed enough to talk to Joseph, all those open strands of miscommunication or lack of communication between brothers throughout the story of Genesis can come to a close. We can finally see that there's a way to move past that. But of course, while all of this is very moving and great, we see brothers coming together, the story of Genesis, more broadly speaking, is not merely a story about brothers. We have a lot of other relationships. The first relationship we saw was a relationship between a person and God. Then we saw a relationship between spouses. We saw that the word love enters a story to describe the relationship between father and son, Abraham and Isaac. So what about all of those relationships? Where does this powerful, compassionate, accepting reunion between Joseph and his brothers leave them? And this is where this week's parsha, to a great extent, comes in to show us how the reunion between the brother rebuilds the family, including Jacob and including the brother's children, into the fold. It puts the story of these brothers reuniting into a broader context of other relationships. The first to be brought in, of course, is the father, Jacob. And the moment of reunion is one of the most moving scenes, I think, in the Hebrew Bible. We're not going to read it at length. I'm here in box 5. I'll just read the moment of reunion itself. I'm jumping straight to verse 29. Joseph ordered his chariot and went to Goshen to meet his father Israel. He presented himself to him, and embracing him around the neck, he wept on his neck a good while. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Now I can die, having seen for myself that you are still alive." Then Joseph said to his brother and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell the news to Paro and say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household who are in the land of Canaan have come to me.'" It's very moving. It's very special. And we got to ask ourselves, did Jacob learn anything from all of this experience? We saw that Joseph learned things. We saw that Judah learned things. We saw that Joseph both learned compassion and learned or found a way to offer an interpretive context that allows the family to come together. We saw that Judah became capable of accepting his father's preferential treatment of another person. But did Jacob change at all? And the answer that seems to arise from the following chapters and the closing chapters of Genesis is a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. He didn't change and he did change. What do I mean by that? On the one hand, Jacob continues to unabashedly show preference to his beloved Rachel and her children. We see it in several key moments in the story. For example, I'm in box 6. For example, when Jacob talks to Joseph before his death, he invites Joseph for a private conversation. We only see that between him and Joseph. We don't see that with any of the other brothers. And he says the following one in verse 5, "Now, your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt shall be mine. Ephraim and Menashe shall be mine no less than Reuven and Shimon. He offers a special status to Joseph's sons, that they become equal to his own sons in all matters of inheritance and all matters of identity, in a way that he doesn't offer to any of the children of the other children, to any of the other grandkids. More than that, he tells Joseph that he's going to give him extra in the inheritance. He says, I'm in chapter, I'm again in the same chapter, but one quote below. Then Israel said to Joseph, I am about to die, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. And now I assign to you one portion more than to your brothers, which I wrested from the Amorites with my sword and bow. Lest we think it's only towards Joseph that he shows this preference, we can look now at the way that he tells all of his children right before his death about where he wants to be buried, and see that he still shows a preferential treatment to Rachel, or more specifically, a dismissive attitude towards Leah. When Jacob, on his deathbed, asks his children to go and bury him in Me'arat HaMachpelah, the same cave that Abraham bought in Hebron to bury Sarah in, he says the following. There, Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried. There, Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried. And there, I buried Leah. Where is then my wife? There's a certain pattern he's establishing. A person and his wife, a person and his wife, a person and his wife. Leah is not my wife. It reminds us what how Yehuda quotes his own father saying, two sons my wife gave me. The wife is Rachel. Everybody else is an afterthought. And it's on this note that Jacob dies. I'm jumping to verse 33. When Jacob finishes instruction to his sons, he threw his feet into his bed and breathing his last, he was gathered to his people. So it's not as if Jacob suddenly changes spots. It's not as if that love, that destructive, subversive love that we watched being born by a well and motivating Jacob to remove a stone off the well and break social expectations, the same powerful, subversive love continues and stays with Jacob and walks with him all the way to his death. But at the same time, and in this very same set of scenes, when we watch Jacob giving his last words to his sons, we also see him for the very first time call a son of Leah with the word Bni, my son. Isn't it striking that until this point he only calls the sons of Rachel Bni, my son, like that in this personal appellation? He talks to Esau about the sons I got. He doesn't disown them, but the intimate Bni, the Bni that Abraham offered to Isaac as they were walking to the Akedah, to the moment of the binding of Isaac, the Bni that denotes a personal connection, the Bni that we saw Jacob offer Joseph over and over again, is only offered to a son of Leah at the very end. And it's offered as part of an acknowledgement of this son's, Yehuda in particular, special leadership role in the family. Jacob says, you, O Judah, your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the nape of your foes. Your father's son shall bow low to you. It's reminiscent of the blessing that Isaac gave to Yaakov, thinking he's Esav, when he says that your brothers shall bow to you. But now Jacob does it in full knowledge of who is seeing. Judah is a lion's whelp on prey. My son, have you grown? He crouches, lies down like a lion, like the king of beasts. Who dare rouse him? And here it is, the my son that we haven't seen until this moment. And on that note, Jacob dies. And where does he leave us? Where does this unique man that we've been following for the past few weeks leave us? The man who had to struggle with his brother, with his father, with the result of his mother's machination, with his father-in-law, with his very wives, with his children. The man who struggled and struggled and struggled and struggled is dead. And for the first time, he leaves us not with a chosen son and rejected children, For the first time in the family of Abraham, we see someone who leaves the covenant as an inheritance for the entire family, for the entire group of sons to carry forth. Rabbi Sacks, in his introduction to his machzor, his prayer book for Yom Kippur, points out that until Joseph and his brothers, we do not see stories of forgiveness in the Hebrew Bible. When Joseph accepts his brothers back, when Joseph opens the door to reunion, he also opens the door to forgiveness between human beings. In a way, the story that continues from this point, from Jacob's death, the story that becomes very quickly a story of a nation and no longer of a family, could not have continued without this foundation of forgiveness. Because people can't stay as a group if their fights result in separation, in secession, in goodbye. They can't stay together if when Lot feels like there's too much discontent, he walks away. They can't stay together when Esav and Jacob feel like the land can't carry both of them, like they're constantly like a yin and yang to each other, and the only way to remain at peace is to travel away from one another. We can only continue when the break is followed not just by saying, I forgive you, but by living and moving on together. And as if to highlight that this has now become possible, that people can move on, that people can recreate a family together, we have one more scene of Joseph and his brothers struggling together with their past. And this scene takes place after they bury Jacob together. And the brothers suddenly realizing that their father, whose influence maybe stopped Joseph from avenging himself against them, is no longer there. They come up with a way to once again ask Joseph to promise not to hurt them. And this is what happens. Actually, seems like I did not include that here, so I'll just say it. You can see it for yourself later. In that scene, when the brothers beg Joseph not to avenge, he cries again. And then he once again repeats what he told them before and says, you, chashavtem lera, your thought was bad, your intentions were bad, but God's intentions were good. And they cry all together and they move on with their life. And they're close enough together. They move enough together as a family that when Joseph is on his own deathbed, he trusts them with his requests. And his request is the following. Here, just a moment. I am in box 9. At length, Joseph said to his brother, I am about to die. God will surely take notice of you and bring you up from this land to the land that he promised an oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. So Joseph made the son of Israel swear, saying, when God has taken notice of you, you shall carry up my bones from here. Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. Within 3 verses, we are seeing both the happy ending and the tragic ending of the story. The happy ending is that Joseph has this relationship with his brothers now, despite the difficulties, despite the history, where he wants to be with them, where he can trust them to take him with them when they go home. The tragedy, of course, is that now that the family is finally reunited, finally everybody together, finally people overcome the things that blocked them from being with one another, be it lack of compassion, lack of acceptance, fear. The place where it all happens, the place where they finally can come together and be a family like that, an entire family that continues a covenant all together, is the land of Egypt. Now, I want to say one more thing about why this ending is both tragic and optimistic. But before I say that, I'll take some of the questions in the chat. Moment. Hannah Gatel Elbaum pointed out, looking at the timeline here, Benjamin is almost certainly an adult by this point. Interesting that he didn't accompany his brothers the first time. And I think that it's alluded here and alluded. It's not mentioned perhaps, but it's present that Jacob doesn't want to let him out of his sight. Jacob wants to keep him with him. It also makes the fact that Yehuda describes him as Na'al especially symbolic and poignant, because he's not a Na'al. He's an adult at this point. He has his own family, according to the sages and their commentators. And yet, for this scene, for this kind of primal archetypical scene of everybody standing together and Yehuda having to decide how he acts, this moment of a knife and a bound boy on an altar, not really a knife, a metaphysical, a symbolic knife, this is the point where the word nar is appropriate. A moment. Judith Gordon wrote, I just heard a teaching that the connection of compassion to lechem, the womb, compassion is making a space for the other just as a womb makes space for another. That's really beautiful. I think it's also especially powerful here, by the way, because just as we see Joseph having this moment of compassion, of seeing these others, the brothers, and making room for them, he's almost foreshadowing a moment that will come a few chapters later, but in a different book, where an Egyptian princess sees a Hebrew boy crying and makes room for him in her life. And even though he's not a child of her womb, she becomes his mother and raises the man who will bring us out of the Egypt we end the story in. iPad wrote, in fairness to the brothers, when they did what they did, as Sherlock Holmes might say, the game was afoot, i.e. who would come out, who would come out on top as leader was still unknown. But when Joseph encounters his brother in Egypt, Joseph is clearly and firmly on top and control. He is won. Many don't like to kick someone when they are down. I mean, I hear what you're saying. I'm not sure I agree, because I think at this point when the brothers are sitting and Joseph is in the hall, I think they can, we can safely say that it looks like they won. They're obviously not going to let him go home at this point. At this point, they're either going to kill him or sell him or find some other way to remove him off the table. And I think that they could be forgiven for congratulating themselves at this point for finishing the game, so to speak. But I do hear what you're saying, that he's in such a position of power that he can allow himself to be magnanimous in a sense. Norm Finkelberg wrote, you have mentioned many times the destructive consequences of lack of transparency, lack of honest communication. Are there any examples in Tanakh of the opposite? Destructive consequences of being completely honest, i.e. too much information. That's a really good question. I can't say that I have off the top of my head. I'm sure I've seen some. Do you have any ideas, Norm? Do you have any examples come to mind? No? Anybody else? Speak up if you do. I'll think about it. Sorry?
There are some of the stories involving King David with messengers bringing the wrong message might come near to that category.
Mm-hmm. You mean when Absalom dies and there's messengers telling him that Absalom died?
Yeah, and with Shaul and probably some other places I forgot.
Yeah, so I would agree that there are moments in the David and Shaul saga when some people say the naked truth and it's very painful, but I'm not sure that they have the same kind of destructive consequences as we see here. I don't think they necessarily lead to the same consequence. But it's an excellent question. You know what? We'll all think about it. This is a great thought for the future. So thank you, Norm. Rebecca wrote,
Shmuel relation with Shaul.
Yeah, Shmuel with Shaul. And again, it destroyed Shaul's feelings. Like when Shmuel as a ghost tells Shaul that tomorrow you and my sons are with me, Shaul falls down. But then he does raise himself and go and fight the battle. So again, we see a very painful revelation, but it doesn't seem to have the same long-term negative consequences, I would say. Well, you know what? Let's think about it later. Thank you, Norm. This is an excellent question. I'll think about it some more. Rebecca Rottenberg wrote, do we take this as what Yaakov said or the way Yehuda is retelling it and the message he wants to make? It's an interesting point. I think that to answer it fully, we really have to go into the text in a way we can't do right now and really compare it. But I do think that enough of what Yehuda says is there in the text that describes events in Canaan, which we don't have time to look at right now, for it to be either enough of a representation that it's true, or I would argue that if anything, it's a representation of Yehuda's feelings. Not so much what Yehuda wants to present as much as Yehuda's deep confidence that his father cares about Benjamin more than he cares about him, which is substantiated by the facts of what actually went below. All of that said, I agree that he's also trying to make a rhetorical point here. He's trying to make move Joseph to compassion in particular.
I think Nair also is another time that that might be the case. If he keeps emphasizing Benjamin is so young, you know, he's so young, mm-hmm. so precious to my father, whether it's whether he's treated that way also, but it works for him in his speech.
Yeah.
And what even is the point he's trying to make?
I would argue, though, that here it's a little bit of a dangerous point to try and make. It's a little bit of a dangerous finessing kind of thing to do because Benjamin is right there. Joseph sees him. If Benjamin is visibly not the child that he's presenting him to be, it might fall in the wrong way. The kind of asking for compassion because this is a young boy but look, I see already that there's a lot of great questions and I'm willing to stay after the class and answer more of your questions if you're interested. But I do, since I want to respect your time and I know some of you have to leave, it's the end of the class. I do want to say one final remark first to close our conversation here, to close the course, sadly. In our discussion today, we really focused on conversations between brothers, between the brothers and their father. We focused on a lot of those internal conversations that happen within the family of Jacob. But all of these conversations are happening in a broader context. They're happening in Egypt, where Pharaoh is the king, where there are soldiers doing what Joseph tells them. And even though Joseph kicks out all that tendency before the great finale of his reveal, they're there. People hear him crying and the word comes to the house of Pharaoh. And there's something very ominous happening in the space, the emotional space between Jacob's family and the Pharaoh court. Something that is already the root of what's to come after. And Yoram Chazoni wrote about it in his book, The Philosophy of Hebrew Scripture, which I think is a wonderful book that everybody should read, strongly recommended. And he highlighted the fact that when Jacob dies, Joseph doesn't say, okay, we're going to bury my father. Instead, he finds a stratagem. He finds a way to beg Pharaoh to let him go bury his father. I'm here at the last box, box 9, Genesis 15. And when the wailing period was over, Joseph spoke to Pharaoh's court saying, do me this favor and lay this appeal before Pharaoh. My father made me swear saying, I am about to die. Be sure to bury me in the grave, which I made ready for myself in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, let me go up and bury my father. Then I shall return. Note that he's not talking directly to Pharaoh. He's talking to the other people, asking them to speak to Pharaoh on his behalf. And the way he frames his request is not, I want to do this, bye-bye, is, I promised, I had to promise, he made me promise, please let me do it, and I promised to come back. And it is this request that Pharaoh responds with agreement, saying, Pharaoh said, go and bury your father as he made you promise an oath. And then we hear the slightly ominous mention at the end of verse 8. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the region of Goshen. Joseph and his brothers themselves go to bury their father, but their families are held back. They're not going. Now, it may be innocent enough. It may be that the children are too young, or that the procession is too big, or something like that. Or it may be an unstated truth that Paro, who wants Joseph to come back, who needs Joseph to come back, who relies on Joseph as his own right-hand man, is holding all the children hostage. The reason it's so ominous here is because we will hear a different Paro in the next book of the Hebrew Bible make a similar condition in one of his many negotiations with Moshe and Aaron. That Paro will say, okay, fine, you and the people go, but leave the children here. And part of Moshe's insistence is, no, we will all go and worship God in the desert. We will not leave any hostages behind. The fact that Joseph feels the need to manipulate and play a game and complicate matters in order to receive Paro's permission, the fact that he leaves his children behind, whether consciously or unconsciously, but certainly as hostages in some sense of the word, tells us that while Joseph may be almost all-powerful in Egypt, he is still completely beholden to the king who gives him this power. And here's what Yoram Chazoni writes about it. Mighty though Joseph may be, he is not free. No longer a shepherd like his fathers, he is instead a servant to Paro in the house of bondage. There is no question, of course, that a man such as Joseph necessarily feels himself free as he gives out orders to others. But compelling as his experience may be, it is an illusion. The first among slaves may be powerful, but a slave he remains, subject to annihilation by his master at a moment's notice, at Paro's house no less than in the house of Potiphar. When once he is faced with the prospect of Paro's wrath and a possible loss of favor, Joseph is struck with the self-same terror of the Hebrew slaves facing that other Paro generations later. It is here, in the Egyptian crucible, that Jacob's family becomes a nation. It is also here that they have to learn to overcome this fear, this enslavement of emotion. It is also here that they have to overcome not only their estrangement from one another, but their dependence on powers outside themselves. They will find that in God and in their relationship with him, and they will find it in each other and themselves. But this is already the next chapter. And like Joseph, we can only hope that the next chapter, the next turn of the road, will take us back home. Will take us back to a better place. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
Rachel, is this your last class?
This is the last class in this course. We're going to have another course with Torah in Motion. We're not clear yet on when exactly. Right.
Now let us know. You are just brilliant.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I don't mind staying for a few more minutes to answer more of the questions in the chat. Is that okay, Maxine?
Yes, of course.
I'm sorry? Somebody asked me something?
He's just not muted.
I see. Okay. Okay. So I'm going to go back to the chat. Moment. Suri Rudolph pointed out, eventually Yaakov does reciprocate. He gives Yehuda the leadership blessing. Correct. I agree. Lisa Malaley wrote, Jacob, in effect, asked to be buried next to Leah. If he showed preference to Rachel, it would have been with her on this side of the road to the way to Canaan. This is a good point, but even though he calls Rachel his wife and Leah, he doesn't call his wife. It does look like there's a certain choice to be buried there. I think that the emphasis he himself lays there is on being buried with his fathers. He talks about it as being buried with his fathers, Avram and Isaac. So I think that's more the emphasis that he lays there, but it's a fair point. Jennifer Malvin writes, How does Jacob show by his last blessing that he is embracing all of his sons? So I wouldn't go necessarily that far, honestly. I think that some of the blessings are very critical and pointed. But the fact that he is blessing all of them, but all of them have a place around his deathbed, is very important. And by the way, Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen Milublin, a big Hasidic rabbi and interpreter, said that Jacob's bed is a symbol, and it's a symbol. Why is Jacob's bed so important? Because Jacob's bed, which he means not his deathbed, he means the bed where he conceived his children, or where his wives conceived his children, all the children who were conceived in this bed continue the covenant. All of them have a place. It's not the same place necessary. It's not always a pleasant place, but it stands out that everybody of his continues, unlike in a way that his fathers weren't zoche to see. Another question from Jennifer. Since there is nothing extraneous in the Torah, why does Joseph test his brothers twice, one with money and one with a goblet? What is the difference between each test? So the first test you're referring to, I'm just going to sum it up quickly. The first time he sends them up without Shimon, when he says bring Benjamin, he puts the money they paid for food back in their bags. I think it's a different kind of test because there he's making it more advantageous for them not to come back. He makes fear of coming back and facing charges delay them to see whether they're going to come back for Shimon. The test later with the goblet in Benjamin's bag is to see not whether they're going to come back for a brother, but whether when push comes to shove, they'll stand up for Rachel's son. It's a one layer up in a sense.
Good one.
Yeah. Susanna Levin wrote, interesting odd that Joseph being younger dies younger than his brothers. True. I don't know what to make of it, but you're right. It is interesting. It's a good point. iPad wrote, the oath Joseph makes his brothers take, presumably renewed with each generation, continues the wedge between the tribe's brothers, since this vow should have been made only by Joseph's son. By Joseph's son only. I'm not sure what you mean. Do you mean that Joseph's son should vow to bring him back? Are you still here?
Yes, I mean that Joseph's son, that's a promise for sons to their father to make it for him only and not the brothers, and then to renew it in order for them to do it generations later, perpetuates the story of how he and that and those tribes were rulers over the other tribes. It continues the story of the divisions between them and who's on top and who's on bottom.
That's really interesting because I see what you're saying, but I actually see it as almost entirely the opposite, because he's asking not his sons to vow, right? He's asking his brothers to vow. And it's almost as if, I'll put it this way. I once read, I have three young children, and as you can imagine, three young children in a household means a lot of sibling rivalry and fights. And I read a lot of psychology books, self-help psychology books, to try and help me handle the situation. And one thing that I saw coming up over and over again is that sometimes for being forgiven, being in the position of the one being forgiven is harder than being the one offering forgiveness. The person who offers forgiveness can move on. The person who did something bad and is now forgiven, they feel like they didn't pay. There's a certain feeling in human psychology that you feel like you didn't pay. When I read this request, when Joseph makes the brothers promise something very meaningful to him, I feel almost like he's letting them, he's giving them the opportunity to feel like they're doing something for him and feel like they paid. And
but they're not the ones who are going to carry it out, as he acknowledges. It's their kids' kids' kids, which perpetuates that thing, rather than his kids and grandkids or great-grandkids doing it.
Yeah, and I think it's pretty clear when you look at the history of the generations following the Exodus that the story of Joseph and his brothers weren't forgotten. People remembered how they ended up in Egypt. In fact, the division between Rachel's sons, specifically Joseph, and the brothers also wasn't over. It split the kingdom in David's grandson's days. So I don't think that it's necessarily, I accept disposition. I'm just saying that for me personally, you can say it reminds them of the division, but at the same token, it also reminds them that there is a healing afterwards. By the way, in Midrash Shir HaShirim, in the old sages writing about the Song of Songs, there's this really beautiful Midrash about a verse that I can't remember fully now, but there's a verse in Shir HaShirim that someone disappears. I look for my beloved and he's not there, or something like that. And the Midrash says, oh, this is about Moses. On the night they were about to go out of Egypt, everybody was looking for Moses. I mean, everybody's ready. They're finally ready to walk out the door, and Moses isn't there. Where is Moses? What happened to Moses? And the reason he wasn't there is because he remembered the old promise that was made to Joseph, and he went to retrieve Joseph's bones. And there's a following midrash that throughout all the years in the desert, Moshe kept the bones with him. He took this promise very, very personally. So when I look at it like that, I choose to see the positive aspect of it, even though I accept what you're saying, that in the same, you could say the opposite, that by reminding them of this division, of the need for a promise, it also reminds them that they were divided preceding that. But thank you. It's very valuable to have two perspectives. Yes, somebody's just said something.
And there's a midrash that Serach bar Asher helps him find the bones. So that brings yet another tribe into it.
I didn't know that one. That's really beautiful. That Serach bar Asher helps to heal the breach for Jacob in the midrash, and then later again. Yes, Sev. I just hit on your question. Yes.
Well, separately, by asking all his brothers to do this, there's another example of him trusting them.
Mm-hmm.
And forgiving them. It shows that he trusts them, that they'll do what he asks them to do.
Yeah, even though, I mean, you could argue also that the fact that he wants them to swear shows perhaps a lack of trust on some level, right? That he's not just saying, please bring me up. He says, swear to me.
Oh, so but then again, he's going to say swear too.
Yeah, but then to put it in context also, many people in the Bible, many fathers ask their sons to swear. It seems like a more common medium of communication. So thank you for your point, Zev. And I see a question from you here. Or comment. It seems Joseph's brothers all died and were buried in Egypt. Why didn't their progeny take them all back to the promised land, especially Judah? Excellent question. I think it again highlights the fact that there's something about Joseph. Joseph is the only one who didn't choose to come to Egypt. All the brothers came to Egypt by choice to survive. Joseph is the only one who was sold there. They're the ones who made him go there. So he's giving them an opportunity to retrieve him on some level. Naomi Bariam wrote, this has been an amazing class. Thank you. and thank you. I appreciate it very much. Zmira wrote, don't you think that the brothers' reconciliation between themselves and their father, particularly in Yehuda's case, allows for Yaakov to be reconciled with a deceased beloved wife whose disappointment and pain he almost ignored when she complained of her having no child of his? Maybe. I'd like to believe that. I don't know. I have to think about it. Thank you for the comment. I'm not sure. Linda Heppner wrote, the entire story almost predicts the two exiles, Assyrian and Babylonian. That's a really interesting comment. If we have a class on Shmot, I'll be happy to hear more about what you mean by that. Are you still here, Linda? Okay, so it's an interesting point.
I am here.
You are, Linda. Yes.
Yeah, I had to look for the little button. It just occurred to me, and I can't really sort it all out, but you perhaps can in some future date. I was just thinking about how the, first of all, the Assyrians took away all of the tribes of Joseph and all of the northerners. They disappeared. And then later on, it was Yehuda and those tribes, and they were sort of reconciled at the end. It's sort of inchoate in my mind, but I just have a feeling that there's something there. The disappearance of the tribes, and which happened because of of internal divisions. They allowed the enemy to come in and so on. Mm-hmm. But it's be interested really to sort all that out at some point.
It's interesting, and it's I think I'm not 100% sure I understand what you mean, but if I understand correctly, what you're pointing out is the fact that the division, I mean, it kind of goes back to the theme we've been seeing throughout the book of Genesis, where whenever brothers fight, the road to exile opens up underneath their feet. We saw that from Cain and Hevel onwards, but whenever there was a war between brothers or a fight between brothers, there was some opening for disaster, for leaving home. And in a sense, we will see the same thing on the national level for sure, with that the splits between the people weaken them later as a nation and invite exile, invite someone, an external enemy to come and exile them. So I don't know exactly about the specifics of the Assyrian and Babylonian. I'm not sure what you mean by the specifics of Assyrian and Babylonian, but I think there's definitely something there. And maybe at some future time we can develop that a bit longer. So thank you for the eye-opening comment.
Thank you.
iPad wrote, many of the 10 tribes came down to Judah as refugees. So the reverse of Egypt. It's interesting what you're pointing out, that just like the brothers come to Joseph as refugees, now after the Assyrian conquest, the remnants of Joseph come to Judah as a refugee to feed them, much as Joseph feeds his brothers here. Okay, on this note, I'm going to say one more thing. I'm going to say that it's been a pleasure. I feel like I learned a lot from your questions and interaction during these past 10 meetings. And I thank you very much. And I hope to see you in our next class, which I'm not sure yet when exactly it's going to be, but Rabbi Kalman and I will continue discussing it. Thank you so much. And Maxine, I'm giving the mic back to you.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much. And thank you for being, you know, so generous with your time, kind of wrapping everything up. Really looking forward to having you again and later today at 2:00, Rabbi Dr. Jeremy England is teaching again on, scientific reasoning and in the Chumash. And going on this week, tomorrow, of course, we have Dr. Soklo is teaching about the evolution of the Tanakh. Then Thursday is the Parshat HaShavua Shir. This week, it's Rabbi Brem Weinberg teaching. And Friday morning, of course, Rabbi Kalman is teaching on the Siddur. So looking forward to seeing some of you this week and again when Rachel is back. Thank you so much.